Are there any glaring omissions or distortions in the way the November 13th Paris attacks are being presented in the mainstream media? How effective have counter-narratives in the independent media been, and how could the powers that be respond to that kind of messaging? How authentic is the French president's claim that his country's recent airstrikes in Syria are a direct result of the attacks? What are the consequences for civil liberties in the French Republic and for refugee flows out of Syria? On this week's Global Research News Hour, we take a look at the Paris bombings with two guests. Media critic Barry Zwicker evaluates mainstream and independent media coverage of the attacks, while Professor Michel Chossudovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization dissects the actions of the French government and its allies, given documented research into the Islamic extremist militants, such as ISIL. On this week's show, Parisian deception, manipulating the public into war. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 20th, 2015. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We also can now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. For the last 12 hours, we've been constantly refreshing Google News for just one Western article about Putin's bombshell comments at the G20 summit in Antalya. You would think that the Russian president stating publicly that ISIS is receiving money from 40 different countries, including G20 members, would be newsworthy, right? Typically, at least the Daily Beast has the common courtesy to distort or misrepresent the most recent Putin press conference. But in this instance, there is literally no written Western record of Putin saying anything about who finances ISIS during the G20 summit in Turkey. That comes from the article, Putin outed ISIS's G20 financiers, but not a single Western media outlet has reported it. By Rudy Panko, posted November 19th, originally appearing at Russia Insider. The Kurds have seized and now maintain control of an area that spans the Turkey-Syria border from its western to eastern extremities, all except for one small pocket in the middle, from Jarablus in the east to Dabik in the west. Others have described the zone in slightly different dimensions as being from Jarablus in the east to Afrin in the east. With the growing awareness of the importance of the Jarablus corridor amongst researchers, observers, and the interested national parties, the recent Turkish-US joint military operation agreement stands as a last-ditch effort to solidify the ISIS-NATO presence in Syria. By engaging troops and military hardware over the quote-unquote safe zone of the Jarablus corridor, NATO will be able to ensure that ISIS supplies and soldiers continue to pour into Syria unabated. By placing NATO interests in the midst of the corridor and declaring the zone a quote-unquote safe zone, the hope is that the Russians will see the zone as off-limits. That comes from the article, U.S.-Turkey Joint Operation Designed to Save ISIS, Not Destroy It, by Brandon Turbeville, posted November 18th, originally appearing in Activist Post. The Saudis and Emiratis may have just recently incorporated Eritrea into their coalition framework, but Qatar has been cultivating close ties with Asmara for the past 5 years as part of its mediation role in resolving the Djibouti border dispute, which incidentally saw it deploy 200 troops to the country. This means that the Muslim Brotherhood espousing state is in a position to project its ideology throughout the region and intensify cooperation with its Al-Shabaab proxy in nearby Somalia. In such circumstances, the GCC wouldn't be able to indefinitely hold out the threat of Islamic-inspired terrorist destabilization as a means of blackmailing the world's fastest-growing economy and one of Africa's up-and-coming powers, but would have to reluctantly join in the Qatari-initiated unrest so as to secure whatever benefits they can while there's still the opportunity to do so. The ethnic, social, and religious cleavages already prevalent, and even overlapping in some cases, in Ethiopia provide more than enough domestic gunpowder for a strategically placed spark to set the whole powder keg aflame, with the only fail-safe solution being for Addis Ababa to overwhelmingly respond with military force. Such a reaction might predictably scare away the investors that are needed to keep the Ethiopian miracle alive, and the combination of capital outflow plus military suppression, no matter how justified it may seem, might further exacerbate the domestic differences in the country and place them in a perpetual process of worsening up to the point of the country approaching the geopolitical abyss of disillusion along pre-existing ethnic federative lines. That comes from the article, Saudi Arabia and the GCC are expanding to Eritrea, geopolitical implications for Ethiopia, by Andrew Korybko, posted November 18th, originally appearing at Katahan. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. On Friday, November 13th, six separate attacks with guns and suicide bombs left 129 people dead. The blame was quickly shifted to the Islamic State and used as a pretext for France's massive military strikes in Syria over the weekend, as well as the closing of borders and the severe restrictions of civil liberties in the country. Essentially, the French government has declared martial law. Media is an important agent in assessing the justification for these measures, so the Global Research News Hour got in touch with a prominent Canadian media critic to get his thoughts about the way the attacks and their fallout are being covered. Barry Zwicker is a veteran journalist, commentator, and media critic. He is the author of the 2006 book Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11, and is working on another book focusing on a history of false flag operations. Good morning, Barry Zwicker.
Good morning, Michael.
Okay, so last week we saw these devastating attacks in Paris, 129 people killed, and six separate attacks, and of course just this week we had this big raid. And I know that you've argued that the attacks of 9/11 and the Ottawa shootings a year ago were orchestrated by the state and not by rogue Islamic extremists acting on their own. I'm assuming that you strongly suspect that the attacks in Paris were likewise fit the profile of a classic false flag. And I was wondering what aspects of last week's events would lead you to that suspicion.
Well, you are correct in your assumption, and I think it's well founded. It's based on, in part, actually, the sort of two-part focus that in an email you and I agreed we could approach this conversation on, and that would be the two areas that relate to the events in Paris. One is coverage of those events by the mainstream media, or the MSM, and the MSM being print, that's newspapers and magazines, plus radio, plus TV, and now MSM on the internet. So that's one area. A second area is alternative or counter mainstream media coverage of these events in France. Now that would be on the internet alone. And there's a third area arising from the first two, and that's what you've asked me about, the most important area, really, and that's each person's takeaway on the events, whichever his or her sources of information are. And I don't know, maybe we'll have time to edge into that. But if I may, I'd like to address this question of the mainstream coverage.
Yes.
First. Now, I must say, I hope this is not too much inside baseball, that analysis of media coverage is quite time-consuming if it's done properly. You know, for 3.5 years, I did a weekly commentary for CBC National Radio called Facing the Fourth Estate. This was pre-internet. And each of my commentaries ran 3 minutes, you know, give or take. Typically, I found myself devoting a good part of 2 or even into 3 days researching, writing, and rewriting those 3-minute scripts. Now, fast forward to today, I'm working on a book about false flag ops, as you mentioned in the intro. And for me, the events in Paris are a professional concern, if you will. I mean, I'm touched as a citizen and everything, and as a human being, but they're a professional concern because media coverage of all kinds remains central for me in this book I'm writing, and the mainstream media coverage especially, because the MSM are such a huge problem of malignant manipulation of the public mind. Now, this means I'm experiencing a huge change in my, almost in my job description, self-appointed media critic, of researching and writing. And with the Paris events, this is the first time in my life this has been so clearly the case to me. The number of hours I have to devote to reading and viewing and listening to mainstream media coverage, those number of hours are being rivaled by the number of hours of reading and viewing and listening I must devote to alternative viewpoints on the internet. And, you know, most of the counter coverage includes, not surprisingly, harsh criticism of the MSM coverage. So the question arises, in connection with the Paris events, how do the MSM mislead? And this applies also to, it applied, of course, to 9/11, and it applies to every damn false flag operation that comes down the pike. So there are 3 ways the MSM mislead, roughly speaking, 3 ways. First is by them being stenographers and megaphones for official propaganda. For instance, presenting unfiltered and unquestioned assertions by presidents and generals and the talking heads of spy agencies that specialize in deception, and from so-called counterterrorism experts who work for bodies that usually actually make a profit from terrorism or alleged terrorism. So that's one way, is being amplifiers of official stories. The second way the MSM mislead is by their omissions. An example would be that they raise the roof about 100 and some dead from the alleged Islamic terrorism shootings in Paris. And I mean no disrespect whatsoever for the dead or the grieving in Paris. But these MSM, at the same time, failed to mention the hundreds of thousands of dead from unmistakably Western bombs and shootings in Iraq and Libya and now Syria, or missile strikes from clearly Western drones above Pakistan, and all of which would unquestionably be experienced as terror attacks by the victims and their families in those countries. So these omissions by the MSM constitute systemic hypocrisy.
I would also point out, sorry to interrupt, but there was also the America's, I think it's important to emphasize America's bombing of the, in Afghanistan, of the Médecins Sans Frontières facility and the people who died there. And we don't seem to, that attack didn't seem to get a lot of coverage. I mean, we got some, but it wasn't, didn't get the kind of emphasis that we're seeing with Paris.
Well, probably not, but I was half satisfied by the coverage. I mean, so often these things just don't make it into the papers at all. I mean, there's been all sorts of war crimes committed in Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and Syria, and they involve sometimes thousands of people. I mean, you have, for instance, the quote accidental, and they could be accidental in one sense, you know, bombings of wedding parties in Afghanistan, you know, blowing up people at a wedding or a funeral. And another one that just occurs to me is in Iraq. I don't know if you remember, and I can't really tell you whether it, I think it was the first, you know, Iraq incursion, the one that George Bush Sr. didn't finish. The so-called Allied bombers just wiped out a whole convoy of vehicles and everybody in them. It was about 10 miles long, and they just came and strafed and bombed that whole line, this whole highway full of vehicles. People were burned alive. And I remember it, but it didn't get much coverage, you know. It didn't get the coverage it should have. I think that's your point, right? Mm.
Yeah. Well, what other glaring omissions have you located with regard to the Paris attacks?
Well, the omissions, you know, I'd like to go on to the third form of misleading. I will go on to the third way that the MSM mislead us. But the omissions, and that one is really major, of omitting to mention the much larger terrorist activities of the West when an alleged even terrorist event has happened in the West. I mean, that is your overarching, hypocritical, misleading, mind-boggling omission. But smaller omissions happen. Now, for instance, with Charlie Hebdo, there was a police inspector in Paris who was investigating the circumstances of the Charlie Hebdo massacre. And guess what? You know the answer to what happened to him, eh?
What's that?
He was alleged to have committed suicide, right? Like 2 or 3 days after the massacre, and he's in charge of an investigation. And then they said that he committed suicide. The media omitted to follow up this alleged suicide. Just one small example, Michael, of, you know, the omissions abound. But those are just ones that pop into my mind. But if I may...
it's a common theme, is that, you know, with you know, people just suspiciously dying or getting killed, and you have no witnesses that you can interrogate later.
Well, yeah, I'm not sure whether those fall in the category of omissions as I mean them.
Well, it's questions that journalists should be exploring.
Well, yeah, there are questions that should be explored and aren't. And there are facts that are completely covered up, and then there are ones that are downplayed. So you have total omission, and then you have marginalization or trivialization of events that are known, but they're not being reported with the weight and the size and the placement that they deserve. And that, you know, that all falls under the general umbrella of hypocrisy. Mm. But anyway, there's this third, like you, the, you know, the two forms being propagandizing for the state, and the second one, omission, and the third one is misleading interpretations. Now, you find these misleading interpretations by, you know, what we call the commentariat in the mainstream, and conclusions put forth in editorials. And these interpretations, in turn, you see, are based on the first two of the three legs of manipulation of the public mind, the state propaganda plus the omissions. Then you get the interpretations. Well, it just lays them on, and it just becomes like almost a seamless blanket of lying and hypocrisy. So it's not unfair to characterize the blending of these three as simply serial lies and extreme hypocrisy from and by the mainstream media. Mm-hmm. And that, in turn, tends to hide the malignant complicity of those mainstream media with the terrorism the West inflicts around the world. You know, I mean, it's really a wonder to behold how this all works out. But paradoxically, once a person escapes this admittedly very large bubble of the mainstream propaganda and omission and interpretation, the lies kind of jump out and reveal themselves. Although those still in the bubble still see the lies as truths.
So as we escape the bubble, what are your thoughts about independent media coverage?
Well, that is where it's really rather wonderful that there is so much more counter-information, pushback of facts and interpretation and framing on the internet now for those who decide to access it, and that is really big. Like there are honorable exceptions, of course, within this bubble. You know, you can find sheer facts even in the Paris coverage. I mean, there are things that are incontrovertible. Now, you know, who is behind them is another thing, but it'd be incontrovertible about the number of dead and so on. So, you know, those are facts that you can work with. But the larger truth about the massive hypocritical lying on the really big issues, that truth is hard to access without what Marsha McLuhan called an anti-environment. And he said, we don't know who discovered water, but we know it wasn't a fish. So maybe we're not in a bubble, we're in a fish tank. But and I'll tell you, Michael, I am over the moon that the other day, our 11-year-old granddaughter, I was driving her to her tutorial. We were having a great talk, and I was asking her about her schoolwork. And lo and behold, she quoted that saying by McLuhan, that we don't know who discovered water, but we know it wasn't a fish. And the reason she could quote it to me is because she has a daily media literacy class. So I really thought that is wonderful. Mm. And I think she's already growing up to be a progressive skeptic, and her parents certainly are.
Yeah. I know that you mentioned, I know we've only got a couple of minutes left in this, but you mentioned in your book, The Towers of Deception, that there are so-called gatekeepers, you know, outlets that present as non-corporate and progressive, but they still toe the state line. And you name Noam Chomsky as an example of this phenomenon. Have you been able to locate any examples of that kind of activity with regard to Paris 11-13?
I haven't. Like, I'm in the middle of my research, or even I'm behind with it. I mean, I've got a stack of papers here that I haven't even finished reading that I want to analyze for the wording and the placement and all that. I can't right off the top of my head say that I've identified left gatekeepers in the current situation, but they would be, in regard to Paris, probably the likes of Reader Supported News. Now, Reader Supported News which a lot of people like, and I, you know, follow it because I'm signed up for it every day. Reader-supported news never, ever, ever touches 9/11 truth. And I've been an activist. I haven't just been, you know, sitting and moaning the blues here at my computer. Three separate times, I have communicated with Mark Ash, the founder and the guy who runs Reader Supported News. And in fact, one was an email, and twice I sent him surface mail letters, which were brief and civil. And I've said in each one, in respect to your request for donations, I said, I will give what I can afford to Reader Supported News, even on a monthly basis, if Reader Supported News will touch the matter of 9/11 truth. I have not even received an acknowledgement of those three.
Hmm.
So, you know, there's one of your left gatekeeping portals on the internet, and there are many others. I mean, you can tell them because A, they won't touch 9/11, or B, they will touch 9/11, which means they're a deeper hidden gatekeeper.
Right.
But, you know, if there's just a half a minute left.
Yeah, maybe a minute or so.
Yeah, something that struck me in the course of preparing, you know, for this conversation. And it's what it is. It's a thought or a worry or a threat or something I've had in mind for years now about the internet. And it could even turn into a prediction. And it's this. The minute that for the global elites, the internet's value to them as a surveillance tool appears to them to be the internet's threat to their rule, that is the minute they will, one way or another, deny internet access to everybody who would appear collectively to be on the cusp of mounting an effective program of resistance to the global agenda. And they can do it. I mean, I have no doubt that the global super elite possesses the technical means of doing this and dealing with the pushback. And as a matter of fact, this increasingly full-fledged fear campaign about terrorists and terrorism and terror threats, terror plots and everything, softens up the mass public psyche to be open to such crackdown. And, you know, right in Harper's proposed bill, C-44, was it, or one of the other bills, he would have had it that, quote, supporters of the promotion of terrorism, unquote, you know, would be open to be spied on and even shut down and everything. Or if you're a threat to national security, these vague things. So in other words, all those of us who are progressive skeptics and civil rights and peace and justice and environmental activists, you know, make no mistake, we can be singled out and denied service one way or another, or be so disrupted that our effectiveness is sapped. And people may or may not know about what's called the dark internet or the deep web or internet too. I think they can flip a toggle switch if this other internet is ready with all of us targeted. They can just flip a toggle switch in effect and bang, internet as we know it is gone for a lot of us. But it'd probably be done surreptitiously and in a very sneaky way because there could be a public outcry. But I think they have the technical ability to do it, and they would be waiting for the time to do it and figuring out exactly how to do it. That's my worry.
A very important alert. I thank you for that, Barry Zwicker. I've got to leave now, but thank you again for your analysis of this situation. Very timely, very important.
It is that, and a lot of us have to keep working at it and try to reveal the hidden aspects.
Barry Zwicker is a veteran journalist, commentator, and media critic, author of the 2006 book Towers of Deception, The Media Cover-Up of 9/11. He's working on a new book on false flag operations. He's based in Toronto.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
For his thoughts about the Paris bombings, we're joined by Professor Michel Chossadovsky. Professor Chossadovsky is an award-winning author, professor of economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal, and editor of Global Research. He's the author of 11 books, including America's War on Terrorism from 2005, Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War in 2011, and most recently, The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. He joins us from Montreal. Thanks for joining us, Professor Chossadovsky.
I'm delighted to be on the program.
Is there anything in particular about what has come out about the bombings from the last week that leads you to believe or suspect that these attacks were fabricated, or at the very least, that there was foreknowledge?
Well, I'd rather focus on the issue of the alleged architects of these attacks, because the official story is that this was an act of war from outside France, instigated by the self-proclaimed Islamic State, which has its headquarters in northern Syria in the city of Raqqa. Now, that's the official story. And the French president has emphasized the broader geopolitical and security implications of his assertions. Officially, and that's what the media has picked up, the attacks were depended on the command structures in Syria. They were executed on behalf of the Islamic State, and that this in turn means that France can invoke Article 5, or could invoke Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, which is the founding document of the of NATO, on the grounds of self-defense, and that its allies must come to its rescue, and so on. Now, this kind of logic of saying we've been attacked by the Islamic State, and consequently we are entitled to retribution directed against the Islamic State, involves President Hollande in a very contradictory discourse, because it just so happens that the Islamic State is supported by France's allies and by France itself. The Islamic State is active throughout Syria, but specifically in northern Syria. It has been the object of war waged by government forces in Syria against the terrorists, and these terrorists are known to be supported by the Western Military Alliance. When Obama declared his campaign against the ISIS last August, September, this campaign was in effect, theoretically at least, directed against the same enemies of the Syrian government, namely the so-called jihadist terrorists, Al-Qaeda-affiliated terrorists. And the war campaign, or the bombing campaign initiated by the United States and its allies, was labeled as an anti- or counterterrorism undertaking, when in fact it was a de facto no-fly zone involving bombing campaigns against civilian infrastructure throughout Syria, on the pretext that they were doing they were involved in some kind of humanitarian undertaking. Now, two important occurrences with regard to the Paris bombings. Immediately following the bombing raid, France's president orders that France strike back, so to speak, the empire strikes back against the Islamic State headquarters in Raqqa in northern Syria. And essentially, the French Air Force, out of its military facilities in the United Arab Emirates, sends its warplanes, and starts bombing Raqqa. And then the Ministry of Defense actually indicates that these bombings have targeted the control posts of the Islamic State. But the evidence that we've received subsequent to the French Ministry of Defense's press release is that these airstrikes essentially were intended to destroy Syria's social infrastructure. They targeted a museum, health clinics, and the stadium. And reports suggest that the terrorists were in fact evacuated. Now that pattern is nothing new. From the very outset of the bombing campaign in last August, September, coalition bombings, including those of France, have targeted Syria rather than the Islamic State. And they're using the Islamic State as a pretext. But the problem now the French government has, but in fact the entire coalition, is that they are officially involved in a war on terrorism, but at the same time they're supporting the terrorists. And recent reports have confirmed Turkey's involvement in supporting the terrorists, Saudi Arabia's involvement in supporting the terrorists, and so on. And France's involvement in supporting the terrorists, which started in effect in Libya in 2011 when they supported the Libya Islamic Fighting Group, which is an al-Qaeda-affiliated organization, and that support was directed against the government of Muammar Gaddafi. And it just so happens that the same units of the Libya Islamic Fighting Group now have integrated the Islamic State brigades in northern Syria. So that without necessarily getting into a debate on false flags, I don't think we need to get into a debate on false flags. What we have to underscore and what the French public should realize and what Canadians should realize is that there's a bloody lie there. The French president says we've been attacked by the Islamic State Caliphate. This is an act of war. We closed down our borders. We're being attacked. But who is behind the Islamic State? The French government is behind the Islamic State together with its partners. So you're involved in a non sequitur. And what the media should be reporting on, which is amply documented, it should be connecting the dots, obviously. It should be saying, how is it that the French government is sticking to this discourse that we're being attacked by the Islamic State, while at the same time supporting the Islamic State?
Well, that's the rub, isn't it? Because as with your previous writing on 9/11, I mean, the heart of your research was directed to, well, who is al-Qaeda? And similarly, you said, well, the U.S. and has been supporting and created al-Qaeda as an intelligence asset. And this is essentially the same idea. But the official story is that, well, no, they're an outside enemy. And this is... and it seems like it's very difficult to the rub is that you have to have that admission that the U.S. and its Western allies are supporters of IS. And what we're seeing in this case is that, well, no, we're supporting the moderate terrorists. The moderate rebels in Syria. So I don't know your response to that.
Yes, but the thing is there are various narratives which are contradicting one another. I don't believe that there's any such thing as moderate terrorists. It's a non sequitur. But even if we accept that there are moderate elements within the anti-government forces, which are in fact all mercenaries. I mean, they hired mercenaries. We know, and it's documented. Even the U.S. State Department will say, "Yes, well, okay, Saudi Arabia and Qatar, they're supporting the bad guys. What can we do about it?" But what is never mentioned is that the United States is supporting Saudi Arabia. They're arming Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is a proxy state. So is Qatar. They're not acting on their own volition. They're not arming the rebels and training them and recruiting them and sending, in fact, they're even sending people on death row. Said, yes, we, you know, the prisons of Saudi Arabia have sent inmates to the war theater. And so we're in a situation where France has said we have been attacked by an outside power, that in fact that was exactly the same narrative as what happened on the morning of September 12th when the Atlantic Council met in Brussels and invoked Article 5 of the Washington Treaty, saying that the United States had been attacked by a foreign power, intimating that Afghanistan was attacking America, and consequently we had to strike back under the doctrine of collective security. Now, they're doing exactly the same here. But now they're mixing things together. They're actually what they want is an Article 5 agreement or a similar agreement under clauses of the European Union, which will enable them to escalate the war on Syria. And in effect, they want to wage war on Syria in a sense by equating Syria with this outside force, which are the terrorists. It's a very convoluted argument, and it becomes even more complex because the Russians now say, we are going after the terrorists and we will collaborate with you. And they actually, President Vladimir Putin actually is now establishing a dialogue with François Hollande. Now, why are the Russians doing that? Well, because they're pretty slick diplomats. They know perfectly well that NATO is threatening them. They know that France is firmly allied with the United States. They are committed to waging war on Syria and Iraq. But at the same time, they have to play by their narrative. If they say we're against the war on terrorism, and the Russians say, well, we're also waging the war on terrorism against ISIS, well, let's join hands. And that's a way that's been a way for Russia to create certain divisions within the Western military alliance. And I think that politicians are not always aware of who is manipulating them from behind.
Speaking of politicians, what do you make of the timing of this attacks happening just before the big G20 meeting?
Well, I don't, we can speculate on these timings, and we'd have to start having some more information. But with regard to timing, I think some of the events which preceded the Paris attacks are worth mentioning. The fact that that 1 week before the attacks, the French government ordered the deployment of Charles de Gaulle, the Charles de Gaulle aircraft carrier and its supporting group. It's a formidable force, to the Eastern Mediterranean. That was announced on November the 5th, 1 week before. 2 weeks before, John Brennan, head of the CIA, meets his French counterpart in Paris, and they had discussions at Langley, but they also appeared at a conference at George Washington University. And in fact, the director of French intelligence actually pointed to the fact that France was threatened by an outside force, and he was talking about the Islamic State with its headquarters in Syria. So those consultations took place 2 weeks before. A month and a half before the events, the French magazine Paris Match featured an interview in which actually detailed the fact that a forthcoming terror event was in the planning stage, was likely, was unavoidable. There were other media actually who reflected upon this, I think going back to August. So there were a whole series of events which preceded the main event in Paris. Are they related or not? At this stage, we can simply point them out and without making any further discussion on them, because we don't have sufficient information. But I think they are certainly significant in viewing this process.
In the case of 9/11, which was the other big devastating attack, that triggered the war on Afghanistan and then Iraq, and also the Patriot Act, you know, and other countries brought in severe anti-terrorism legislation. What do you see this latest event triggering as moving to the geopolitical stage? What's going to be the consequences of this attack?
Well, certainly as far as France is concerned, from my standpoint, this is the end of the French Republic. Because when a government declares a state of emergency in response to a terror event prior to the conduct of a police investigation without knowing what are the underlying causes, etc., etc., and then closes the borders and then gives green light to police and security personnel to conduct house arrests, perquisitions and house searches and arrests without a warrant throughout France, not only throughout France. This is a transition towards a police state, and it's coupled also with legislation which seeks to go after the so-called conspiracy theorists, the alternative media within France, people who might disagree with this media consensus. And I've been following the French news right from the outset, and the discourse is incredible. I mean, they're saying, oh, France is at war. We've been attacked by a foreign power. What should we do? We should liquidate these people, go after them. And then there's a big campaign throughout France, which is largely directed against the Muslim population. We're talking about 10% of the population of France, okay? Something of that order. And so there have been reports as to the number of arrests, the number of house searches, and they're significant, but I would suspect that many of those house searches and arrests and acts of intimidation are simply not reported upon. And it's something which is happening throughout the country and which is terrorizing a significant sector of the French population. And then when you say a War Measures Act, okay, it's a War Measures Act, similar to the one that we in Canada declared in 1970, that state of emergency is symbolic because it really indicates a transition coupled with the other pieces of legislation which I mentioned, towards a de facto police state or totalitarian regime under the, you know, under the facade of French democracy or the French Republic. The French Republic is dead. And that's something we must understand. And France, as opposed to some of its other European partners, has become a staunch American proxy. We don't have the same discourse in Germany or even in Britain or even Italy or Spain. It's the French government, but also the French media and French intellectuals have joined this consensus to say, yes, we are in a state of war. We must defend ourselves. And how do they defend themselves? They send in their powerful naval forces and air force to the Mediterranean to bomb Syria, or to continue bombing Syria on the grounds that they're going after the terrorists. And this is, of course, a criminal act. It's an illegal act. And it's a retribution for an act committed allegedly by the Islamic State, which is supported by the Western Military Alliance. And when I say it's supported by the Western Military Alliance, we're talking about NATO, we're talking about Turkey, we're also talking about the Persian Gulf allies. And in fact, the war, that insurgency in Syria, that terrorist insurgency in Syria from day one in March 2011, was supported by the Western Military Alliance. And this is confirmed by reports emanating from the Israeli and Lebanese press. NATO and the Turkish High Command set up, right from the beginning, a process of recruitment of mujahideen from different countries to join rebel forces in Syria, and this is confirmed by Israeli intelligence sources.
Professor Rashad,
and we've got a lot of other sources to that effect.
Professor Chostadovsky, one of the elements of this is, like one of the terrorists, they said they found a passport that identified him as, it was a fake passport from somebody who had come across as a refugee from Syria. And now here's France has closed the borders. So I'm wondering what all the attacks mean in the context of that migrant, that refugee crisis.
Well, the issue of the passport, of course, is worth looking at because it's an issue pertaining to the planting of fake evidence and then using it, or at least the media will use it, without necessarily pointing to the fact that it could be fake. It's interesting that just recently, today, the German Minister of the Interior, in an interview, said that in his opinion, this passport issue could be a fake. Okay, could be misleading, and so that occasionally we get contradictory statements emanating from people in high office, which will refute the media. Occurrence. In this particular case, it's the German Minister of Interior who made in an interview, I think it was with CNN, where he actually said this could be something which was planted. In fact, he said it's likely that it was planted. But with regard to the refugee crisis, I think Western public opinion should understand that this refugee crisis is the product of 4 years of war waged by the Western Military Alliance through their terrorist foot soldiers, and also by coalition bombings dating back to August of last year. And this has uprooted several hundred thousand people, and these people don't know where to go. I should say that these are probably members of the middle class who have the money and the means to actually undertake, to actually go overseas from, to exit the refugee camps, which are based in Turkey, and take the long route towards Western Europe. But I think that there's a whole psychosis of what, you know, who is with those refugees and so on and so forth. One thing which has to be mentioned is that following the Russian bombings, which were consistent and effective, a large number of mercenary forces, which integrated the terrorist formations, have fled their command posts and have crossed the border into Turkey. And they have integrated the cohorts of refugees which are now moving towards Western Europe, so that there are terrorists within those ranks. Many of those people actually will be protected by their sponsors. We have to understand that. They were recruited by NATO, and now they're refugees. They may be given special treatment, and their access may even be facilitated. But certainly there are terrorists within the ranks of the refugees, but those terrorists are the handlers of the Western Military Alliance, who are fleeing the war theater as a result of the Russian bombings.
Okay. Well, I think we're about out of time now, but Professor Choskovsky, I want to thank you very much for sharing those thoughts with us, and I will have to keep in touch and continue to watch this story as it progresses. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the opportunity of being on the program.
Professor Chosadovsky is Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa and the founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.